It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported Ascension, Wisconsin is no longer staffing critical care physicians in person at some of its smaller intensive care units.
The health system is opting to have the critical care specialists called intensivists available at several of its small locations via video call. In a statement, Ascension says there are protocols in place to manage emergency situations and that the video call option is an improvement over having specialists on call by phone.
The changes took effect as of May 1st at some of Ascension's smaller hospitals. According to the Journal Sentinel, hospital staff say those include facilities in Brookfield, Franklin, and Mequon.
Sarah Volpenhayn is healthcare reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and broke the story. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
From the sources you talked to, what exactly is changing in the way that these intensive care units would work?
Yeah, so previously, these units would either have critical care providers respond in person for part of the day or all of the day, or they would have somebody on call. So if somebody in the ICU needed help from a critical care provider, they would call in somebody who would drive in and arrive in person. So now under this change, basically they're switching to a telemedicine model in the ICUs where the critical care providers will no longer be in person in these certain ICUs, but will be available via video for consultations, and they will be able to monitor to some extent the patients virtually.
And Ascension points out, we got a statement from them, as you did. They point out that there will be physicians on hand, the hospitalists, a different specialty, critical care nurses, access to emergency rooms. When you talked to some staff there, what were some of the concerns about not having the intensivist specialist on hand at least some of the time?
Yeah, so the people I spoke to were just really concerned that in an emergency, an ICU patient might not have the type of doctor that they need. And what was really concerning was a lot of the questions that they had that were unanswered for them. They didn't get a lot of communication going into this change about what the protocols were for emergent situations. If all of a sudden a patient started to code and needed some sort of medical intervention like an intubation or a central line placement that typically an on-site critical care doctor could provide. So they had a lot of questions about, you know, what do we do if a patient suddenly takes a turn and needs some of these interventions that typically the critical care doctor would provide. There were also some questions about what kind of monitoring would be available and how closely the offsite critical care providers would be able to keep an eye on the patients in the ICUs. And that's something that I didn't get a lot of clarity from Ascension on, is exactly to what extent basically the offsite team is able to monitor the patients.
And in their statement, Ascension mentioned that in that emergency situation, that the options would include, hey, there are emergency room physicians and practitioners and staff available to deal with that. Some of the staff you talked to, though, were a little worried about how that was going to work. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, basically, it's unclear exactly what the lines of responsibility are, at least from the perspective of the people that I talked to. There was some concern that emergency room doctors would not feel comfortable leaving their primary responsibility in the ER to respond to an emergency elsewhere. And there's also generally emergency medicine physicians aren't credentialed to take care of inpatient patients, people who are admitted to the hospital. So that was another concern that I heard from the people I talked to.
Sarah, thanks for sharing your reporting with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Sarah Volpenhayn, healthcare reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. To learn more about tele-ICUs, how they work, how widely they're used, we have Dr. Ellie Golestanian, associate professor in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Her focus is on tele-ICU services. Dr. Golestanian, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
How widely used are some forms of telehealth care in intensive care units for these intensivist specialists in particular?
Well, I think nationally, the figure runs something between 13 and 20% of ICU beds that are co-monitored and managed by EICU. There are various a number of different EICU systems throughout the country, and they were really born out of a shortage of intensivists nationally and within Wisconsin itself. And so I can't speak to all the different systems, but I can tell you about our EICU within eCare as part of UW Health. And so our focus is on providing critical care expertise to small hospitals, often rural hospitals throughout the state, and a couple in Illinois, that have ICU beds but do not have an intensivist there. Because, you know, critical care medicine is a specialty. Mm-hmm. We spend our careers managing patients in shock, respiratory failure, sepsis, on ventilators, severe infections, cardiac arrests, and complex physiology that's often rapidly changing. And we're trained to be able to make split-second decisions if that need arises. And so what the EICU system has, I want to stress that it's not simply a critical care physician answering a phone call on their mobile or even by some sort of video system. It's an entire setup that has its own specialized software that pulls in real time patient data for us to review constantly. So we can look at the patient's charts, which are almost all electronic right now, their labs, their imaging, vital signs, ventilator settings, their clinical trends. Trends are extremely important for us to pick up. And we look at those. And most importantly, we work with a dedicated group of bedside physicians and providers and other clinicians, including the nursing staff, obviously, respiratory therapists, occasionally the critical care pharmacists. And we work with them to provide our expertise so that they can better serve their patients and look after their patients.
I want to ask about a particular situation. Someone's in that ICU, they need immediately or more or less immediately a procedure that that intensivist, that critical care physician can provide. What is key to making sure that there's somebody in range, maybe from the emergency room or elsewhere, to provide that particular service quickly?
That's an excellent question. And it's a crucial point because clearly we're not at the bedside. And, you know, we can do almost everything, but we cannot lay our hands on the patients to examine them. And we cannot do procedures. So a crucial factor when we take on a new site is clarifying exactly who is available that can do these emergency procedures. Now, very often, if a nurse notices an emergency situation or a respiratory therapist, we can often more quickly get into the room, like within seconds of being e-alerted. We can more quickly get in there than even the in-house physicians. But having determined that a procedure needs to be done emergently, for example, an emergency intubation, then that procedure must be able to be carried out by a physician who is in-house, whether that is a hospitalist that is trained to do that, which is not very usual. It's more often anesthesiologists who are in-house or emergency room physicians. And so at the very start of taking on a partnership with a new site, we clear these hurdles. We make sure that somebody is there who can do these things. And if, for example, after a patient is intubated, we determine that the resources and bedside staff are not there to take care of an intubated patient and their mechanical ventilation, then we help them make arrangements to transfer the patient out to a tertiary care facility.
I want to clarify, you mentioned that we don't have necessarily enough intensivists to go around for all facilities. In some cases, I assume even if a smaller facility has an intensivist, they don't have one 24 hours a day. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Again, because of the shortage, critical illness, knows no boundaries. Critically ill patients can be ill at nighttime, on weekends, and on holidays. And because EICU platforms are 24/7, oftentimes our role is to provide coverage throughout those hours and days when in-house coverage is less than optimal. So again, at nighttime, we not only serve small remote settings, but also some of the larger hospitals, even in Madison, because at nighttime we can help oversee the care given by, for example, a trainee, a fellow or a resident who is there at the bedside can ask us questions immediately about a patient.
Just briefly, I imagine a patient or a family member, a loved one, might look and see, wait, I'm being monitored from off-site. I imagine there's some reactions of concern to that. In just our last few moments, what do you say, or what do the hospital staff explain to the patient in that situation?
Yes, certainly. And the nursing staff that we work with, who are often the first to be asked that question, are extremely skilled at passing on that information as to who exactly we are and what we do. And if the patient has ongoing questions, we can camera in, they can see us on video, and we can have a direct conversation about what our role is. And I should note that it's important to know that it's not just one physician providing EICU care. We're very much a team, usually a ratio of four highly qualified EICU critical care nurses to one physician, in addition to administrative staff and information technology staff, who ensure that everything is running smoothly and that we can answer questions, including to the family who may have questions for us.
Dr. Golestanian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Ali Golestanian, associate professor in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Earlier we spoke to Sarah Volpenine. We've been talking about EICUs.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, it's this week's edition of Inside Wisconsin Politics. The gang from WPR and PBS Wisconsin answers questions from UW La Crosse students about political polarization, money in politics, and more. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin political reporters are always keeping tabs on what the governor, legislature, and Supreme Court are up to.
Every week, they unpack political events on Inside Wisconsin Politics. And this week, they field questions from political science students at UW La Crosse.
Joining the discussion are WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin senior political reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR political reporter Rich Kramer.
So we want to say up front that if you have questions, you should email us at insidewisconsinpolitics@wpr.org. But the questions we're going to talk about today didn't just come out of nowhere. It turns out Anthony Chergosky, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, watches our show, and he watches it with his students in his legislative process class. We talked to Professor Chergosky a lot. He suggested his students could ask us questions, and he helped set that up. A couple of the students submitted their questions by video, including Riley Bickelhaupt, who wanted to know about political polarization.
Hi, guys. My name is Riley. I'm a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. I'm studying political science and Spanish with a minor in legal studies. My question for you guys today is, how do you think the ongoing political polarization in Wisconsin affects the state's ability to pass bipartisan legislation?
Zach, I feel like there are layers to this answer, which is kind of like the reason we like the question. So where would you begin to answer Riley here?
Last semester, and then hope that their time doesn't run out before summer starts. This is a huge question. It's a good question, Riley. The first thing you have to do is define is what is bipartisan? Because technically, one Democrat joins the Republicans, it's a bipartisan bill, even if all the rest of them oppose it. So we can really stretch the definition. And Sean, you remember back, you know, 20 years ago under Jim Dole, at the end of the year interviews, we'd talk about like controversy in the Capitol and say 90% of the bills we pass are bipartisan. And those statistics are true. Most of those bills are really minor, some technical adjustments, some of those really aren't controversial at all. So they are overwhelmingly bipartisan, but the ones that get our attention, the ones that we track and we follow, are very contentious. And yes, political polarization absolutely factors into the image that your audience or their voters at home will view what happens if they let something pass. And that goes through leadership all the way down. I can tell you for certain that Robin Voss, as Assembly Speaker, knew exactly which districts he had to worry about more vulnerable members, and he would let them vote against Republican bills, because he knew that they had to show they were more moderate or more bipartisan in those areas, or bills that were going to pass, they got to be co-signers on, so that they could say, I helped pass this legislation. So there's a lot of tricks and details into what is bipartisan, but absolutely there's only one bill that needs to be passed each legislative session, and that's the budget. So Sean, my question to you is, if only Republicans in the legislature vote for the budget, all Democrats vote against it, but Governor Evers signs it, is it now bipartisan?
I think it is, yes. I think that the Democratic lawmakers in that situation have the luxury of knowing that their governor's back there to make the call that needs to be made. And if they have issues with it, they can go to the governor and say, hey, maybe take this out or reword this with your partial veto, governor. So I think that's an example of a bipartisan budget. And I think as you've seen the Republican margins shrink, you have seen more Democratic votes on those budgets, too, because you have some of those lawmakers, like you talked about, under this new map, you have lawmakers that are more inclined to represent a 50-50 district. And what do you hear from them when they are campaigning? We want to work across the aisle. That is a go-to message. Rich, how about you? When it comes to bipartisanship and Riley's question, what stands out to you?
So I think what you've both said is totally accurate. A couple things that stick out to me is when there are these bipartisan bills that get our attention because they are major policy issues, it seems like the compromise falls under a couple categories. It's fear or favor. So I think of when the Wisconsin Supreme Court's liberal majority struck down Republican-drawn legislative voting districts as unconstitutional. Shortly after, Republicans actually voted for maps that were drawn by Governor Tony Evers. When they were opposed to the court case, I mean, they were opposed to these maps all along. But yet they voted for the ones from the governor. Why would they do that? Well, one of the theories is that they feared that the Supreme Court justice's liberal majority might draw maps that are more favorable to Democrats than what they ended up passing from Evers. And then when it comes to favor, I think of a bill that passed in and was signed into law this past session that started out as a Republican bill banning people from purchasing soda or candy with federal food assistance. Democrats hated the bill, but it was amended, and Democrats wanted to get a lot of new funding and positions for the Department of Health Services so that it can comply with federal changes to the food assistance program and avoid putting the entire program at risk. Republicans on their own weren't interested in that, but this bill morphed into a soda and candy ban plus $72 million for the Department of Health Services. So that's one of those favor for favor kind of bills.
I think the one thing that I would like to impart upon people who feel like you look around the politics today and it feels extremely polarized, I think that yes, some Democrats and some Republicans legitimately hate the other party and in no uncertain terms. I think the Wisconsin legislature has a lot of moments, though, of actual bipartisanship. I think about the local government funding bill that they passed, shared revenue, we'd call it. I mean, I cannot believe that they did that, Republicans and Democrats, that raised sales taxes in Milwaukee. It's something that you never could have imagined the Republican Party doing years ago. But in Evers' second term, it seems like he's been able to cut those deals. And particularly since he got these new maps, he's been able to cut those deals. And as you alluded to, Zach, Robin Voss sometimes quotes this too. 95%, I think, is the number he gives of the bills that they pass in the Wisconsin legislature are bipartisan because, yeah, the legislature passes a lot of bills that are incremental, and we don't write about them. We don't talk about them as much, but they're there. They do pass a lot of stuff that is not a knockdown, drag-out fight.
And I think we saw two milestone shifts that have occurred over Governor Evers' time in office, where this really came to the head, where a Republican legislature had to work with a Democratic governor. In the first term, Republicans were bound determined to give the governor nothing. They sent him a budget and said, we dare you to sign this. And over, Democrats could not get their bills to come to committee, couldn't get a hearing, never got to the floor. In fact, if Democrats wanted a bill to pass, they would go find a Republican they could work with, and they would have them become the sponsor. So they had to, like, give the Republican credit in order to get it somewhere. And that was in order to make Governor Evers look bad, to weaken him for reelection. But then when he won in 22, Republicans realized, well, we still have another 4 years, so it doesn't make sense to keep spiting ourselves.
Right.
Let's see what we can get done. And so there was a change there. And then the other thing that Rich pointed out is when the maps changed, we saw the electorate change underneath these politicians, and we saw more people running to the middle because they needed to if they wanted to keep their majority and keep that seat. And so we saw more effort to bring things to the floor. And the question that kind of gets back to the heart of what Riley's been looking at is there's a federal image of polarization. There's the theater that comes out of press releases that we see from politicians. And then there's the reality of what it looks like at the end of the day in the chamber when they all walk off the floor back into the assembly parlor where the cameras aren't. And we're allowed to get a little glimpse of them laughing, drinking coffee together, shaking hands. It's nowhere near the old days where they would go drink beer afterwards at the bars. But they still do communicate. A lot of the anger is theater for their voters or for the media.
They are actually people, it turns out, who talk to each other sometimes, and especially back in that chamber, as you mentioned. Riley had kind of a, we'll call it a part two to that. It's a follow-up question. This was submitted by email. Riley asks, how would you describe the effects of social media and misinformation on the political environment in Wisconsin? Rich, let's go to you first in this one. How are social media and misinformation affecting everything in Wisconsin, but especially our politics?
In a big way. I mean, the immediate example that comes to mind is President Donald Trump's false claims about the 2020 election being stolen from him through massive fraud in states like Wisconsin. So he began tweeting about that and has kept it up essentially ever since. So one of those tweets was a direct threat to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, where he said, look, decertify the election, or else, you know, someone's going to run a primary against you. And that ended up happening. You know, Voss said that it's impossible to decertify the election. Eventually, there was a recall effort. And the challenger to Voss was endorsed by President Donald Trump and almost won. I mean, Voss's victory was less than 300 votes. So that would have had a really big impact on just the business of the assembly and the legislature as a whole. So that's one concrete example, but there's all sorts of others. You know, I spend a lot of time on social media, X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it.
You got the question first for a reason, buddy.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not real life compared to people you meet on the street or, you know, but also it bleeds into it. One example is, you know, these young conservatives, Turning Point, they're very, very focused on social media. That's how they get the message out about candidates. That's how they get their gentle threats against lawmakers or party officials that aren't doing what they think they should do. So it does bleed over into real life, but also there's an aspect of it being totally online and in its own universe.
We had another question from Anthony Trigosky's class. This one came from Kylie Scanador, a junior studying political science and criminal justice. She asks, do you think more ideologically extreme candidates hurt their party in a state like Wisconsin, or do these candidates help their party win? Zach, will we get an answer to this one once and for all this November?
Yes and no. And the reason for that is once somebody wins, they are the definition of their party, and certainly for governor. At one point in time, Tom Tiffany was one of the more right-leaning, more, you could label him an extreme. He was one of the early ones to cozy up to Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. He was on the far right of the Republican congressional delegation, and certainly Republicans within the state. Now he is likely the front runner to be the Republican nominee for governor. And if he wins, he will be the face of the Republican Party. And so that shift that occurs means it's no longer about what is extremism, because the voters will vote for whoever they think, you know, favors them. And politicians redefine their own image all the time. We saw another Democrat enter the field for governor, Kirk Bankstead, who has a pretty tawdry history with Democrats themselves, starting Minocqua and lawsuits, and I think he was arrested, and he's on the outs with a lot of these candidates, and he decided recently he was going to run for governor, enter the field, and he did not get the same cordial welcome that the other Democrats did when they announced last year, and he would definitely be considered on the left and a little more of an extreme candidate by most people's views of what is a centrist, moderate, or even a far-left Democrat today. That doesn't mean Republicans won't try and use it against the whole field the same way that Democrats are going to use Donald Trump and his connections to Tom Tiffany against him. But it will be, how will the candidate that emerges be able to redefine themselves as the face of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party?
And he announced for governor shortly after he was visited by federal agents after promising, among other things, to offer free beer when Donald Trump dies. This was after the most recent assassination attempt. So
a perfect example of what Rich is talking about in social media being a little bit of a toxic place, and going right back to Riley's first question about political polarization, it occurs in social media and it does bleed over into the real world.
To me, I think this question really kind of boils down to the word extreme, which is always in the eye of the beholder. You know, like you mentioned, once somebody wins, they become normal. You know, you just become accustomed to that. But I think in 2016, a lot of Democrats, a lot of Republicans certainly considered Donald Trump to be on the extreme end of things. It worked for him. You know, it continues to work for him. And when he's not on the ballot now, Republicans suffer because that's what his voters are looking for. So there's an example where even in a 50-50 state like Wisconsin, where you imagine somebody kind of, you know, wanting to aim for that middle, the more extreme candidate, you know, sometimes is the one who carries the day. Rich, real quick on this one.
Yeah, I wanted to point to, you know, we've got Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden. He's said a lot of inflammatory things. He's on social media a lot, thousands and thousands of tweets probably. And Democrats call him extreme, but he's won re-election. And some conservatives in the 3rd Congressional District like that. They like that about him. They like that about Trump. They feel that that means they're authentic and that they're not listening to the consultant class in crafting their messaging.
All right, I think we need to move on. We're going to shift gears a bit with our last question this week, which comes to us on video. It's about political spending.
Hi, I'm Alex Thiessen. I'm studying political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse. My question today is, with concerns about campaign spending in recent Wisconsin State Supreme Court elections, how would stricter recusal rules change judicial elections? Would new rules reduce direct campaign contributions to candidates? Or would they shift spending towards outside groups such as PACs or political action committees?
So recusal, the idea that when you've got a stake in the case, you're a judge, you step out of that case. Rich, this is not something that's just a theoretical question. Supreme Court justices might consider it soon, right?
That's right. There's a rule petition proposal before the Supreme Court brought by a group of retired judges. And essentially, it would mandate that justices recuse themselves if there are reasonable concerns about donations they got during their campaigns affecting cases. Essentially, if those donations come from parties to the case, lawyers, what have you. But the twist is that it's still up to the individual judge or justice themselves to decide whether or not to recuse. And this rule proposal doesn't include any set dollar limits. That was attempted in a 2017 rule proposal that was rejected by the Supreme Court's former conservative majority. But now we've got a liberal majority, and they've been more open to the idea of some sort of change. But in a lot of ways, this current rule would be very similar to what exists right now on the books.
Zach, for somebody out there that's just kind of wondering, like, why don't justices just adopt a strong recusal rule, put a set dollar amount on it, and say, I'm out if we get above that.
There are so many reasons why that does not work. The first is simply inflation. I mean, a reasonable number that we all could have agreed on 10 years ago would be pennies today when you're talking about $50 and $100 million races, which is not this one, but the last two. And the other one is we now have a loophole in place for fundraising for these judicial candidates that did not exist 20 years ago. It was actually passed by Scott Walker and the Republicans, but it allows anyone to give as much money as they want to the political party, who can then donate that money as much as they want to the candidate. And the reason why giving money to the candidate is better than an outside PAC, which is part of the question, is the candidate gets a better ad rate. So they can buy more TV ads, more online ads for their dollar. So it's much more effective for them to keep doing it that way. And finding what is the actual number, especially if it gets funneled through a party, is a really difficult question to ask. And it brings up the idea of would a group try and donate to their opposite opposing person in the hopes of spiking them off a future case?
That's what the justices say who are skeptical of this. Like, we can't do that. They'll play games.
Yeah. So it really is a thorny question. There's not a simple answer. And unfortunately, well, it comes down to the integrity of the justice, and that's where historically it always rested.
Do we see a lot of recusals on this, though?
Once in a great while, but not on funding.
All right. That's all the time we have for today, but we would love to hear from you. If you have questions for a future show, just email us at insidewisconsinpolitics@wpr.org. Give us your first and last name and let us know what you want to know about Wisconsin politics and government. Thanks for joining us.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporter Rich Kramer.
Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org. And again, if you've got a Wisconsin political question for the team, send it to InsideWisconsinPolitics@WPR.org.
Coming up, a Milwaukee author writes about the triumphs and tragedies of modern motherhood in her new novel. The setting is a small-town Wisconsin supper club on the shores of Lake Michigan.
Wisconsin, to me, is all about food and family, and that's really what the book is about, too.
The book, The Supper Club Saints. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. For some, the ultimate sign that spring has arrived is the day the tractor is fired up.
Writer Chris Hardy reflects on growing up on a family farm with a Ford 640 tractor and how it taught him more than a few virtues. The essay is featured in his book, Back Home, Country Tales Through the Seasons.
Mother Earth is slowly warming, and the season of planting is here. There's a primal need for anyone connected to the soil to dig, till, and plant. Whether you're a backyard gardener or a grain farmer with thousands of acres, we simply must explore the mysteries of the dirt, seed it with life and water, with lots of hope. It's a pattern man has repeated for thousands of years since we stopped relying solely on animals as our source of nutrition. We've come a long way from the days of stone implements. Today, farmers use large tractors to pull massive equipment that plows, harrows, and plants in short order. It was only a few generations ago that farmers moved from horses to tractors. Those early tractors would scarcely be able to move, much less operate today's large implements. When I was young, my dad and my cousin would be busy in the fields with the larger tractors putting in the crops. I remember the smell of the freshly turned soil, the fresh bags of seed that seemed to hold so much promise, and the green fields of new oats emerging from the ground. But the ultimate sign that spring had arrived was the day that we fired up the Ford 640. My brother Kevin dubbed Chet's Chick. I spent many hours on its metal seat raking hay on hot summer days. We used the little gray tractor to pull hay wagons and even chopper boxes. Every spring, there would be the day when we needed the 640. It was usually parked where it was last operated the winter before. We checked the 6-volt battery, the oil, and the radiator, although I don't remember anyone putting coolant in, just water. Sometimes we'd have to evict a family of mice that decided to move under the engine cowling for the winter. The battery would be dead, but we'd either pull it or roll it down the hill, pop the clutch in third gear, and Chet's chick would fire up for another season of work. The tractor tended to slip out of first gear when driving down steep hills, as it did once when Dad, Kevin, and I were coming down with a big load of hay. Kevin was driving and Dad and I were sitting on the hay wagon. Suddenly, we were freewheeling and I started screaming as we rushed toward what I thought was certain death. Dad climbed across the hitch and yelled at Kevin to hit the brakes, which he did, and we skidded to a stop without jackknifing. "Use second gear," Dad said. Lesson learned. Another time, my cousin Brad was driving the tractor and stopped to talk to Dad. He forgot to set the parking brake and the tractor started rolling down a steep hill. Brad started running after it, but stopped when Dad yelled at him to let it go. A little axle work was cheap compared to the injuries Brad could have sustained. Dad sold the tractor after I left the farm because it really wasn't useful for the needs of a modern dairy farm. I often wish it was still here, as it would be perfectly sized for some of the lighter farm chores that I perform. The tractor sold for about $2,000 new, and 60 years later, they still sell for that and more. I learned how to drive on Chet's chick. I learned the value of patience as I circled the same field for hours and hours, turning over furrows of hay. I learned that part of growing up was taking on responsibility, and people depended on me. The tractor helped shape the experience of turning a boy into a man.
Chris Hardy is an author who lives in West Salem. This piece was produced by Tyler Ditter. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
This is WPR News.
An old family-run supper club in a small Wisconsin town by Lake Michigan, that's the setting for a new novel about motherhood.
The Baumhaus Supper Club is the heartbeat of the fictional Port Holcomb community. The family matriarch, Remy, has decided to sell it as she nears retirement. She's still reeling from the loss of her husband to cancer, and her children don't want to run a supper club.
Milwaukee area author Clara Swinarski reads this passage of Remy thinking back to what supper clubs like the Baumhaus used to be like in Wisconsin several generations ago.
Baumhaus meant treehouse in German, and that was exactly what her grandfather and his brothers had been envisioning when they built it. The 50s in Wisconsin were one endless stream of supper clubs. They were brandy old fashions and surf and turf nights, with live bands singing polka songs and Bing Crosby covers. They were the place to be on a Friday night, the hub where you caught up on gossip and got to know your neighbors. Not a cell phone in sight.
Claire Swinarski's new novel is called The Supper Club Saints, and she starts by explaining why a supper club makes an ideal setting.
Supper clubs in general, I think, are fascinating establishments, right? They're local to the Midwest. They're not a place that you can run into just anywhere. And it really does feel like going home. Like you come on in and they give you free food, the bread basket and the relish tray. Nobody is trying to kick you out after a certain number of time. The food tends to be affordable and really hearty fare. And I just think they're these really remarkable homey places that to me represent a lot of the Midwest. And so when I was writing the book and I knew I wanted to make it a very Midwest-centric story, I thought, what better place to center it on?
Because this family, I mean, they're considered like the shining stars of this community. And then this something happens. What is it like for this family when the daughter Cass abruptly leaves with her young daughter and joins this mom influencer household that's hundreds of miles away in the North Woods?
Yeah, I think it's a real knock on the butt. So Cass decides to take her young daughter and move away from the hometown because she thinks that this lifestyle is going to be a better fit for her to go live with these mom influencers on like this mom compound, like all women rah-rah all the time. And I think that for the family to have someone leave in that way, it feels like a massive rejection. And that's probably in a way why Remy is able to handle the emotions of selling the supper club, because she's been through it the past couple of years, right? Her husband has passed away from cancer and her daughter has left. And I think she's just feeling like, you know, a restaurant at the end of the day is a building. It's not a family member, and she's lost family. So to her, I think she's able to put it in that proper perspective. But yeah, it's really, really hard on the family for sure.
And in this momune, as you call it, there's this head of the house of mom influencers who's making all these social media videos. And these moms are trying to show how they can raise their children together, you know, on their own terms without fathers. And they're really intense helicopter parenting. How does this intensity of parenting rub off on Cass?
I think when you are in those throes of early motherhood and you're feeling really overwhelmed and kind of lost, and Cass is struggling with some postpartum mental health, what you are really craving is someone with answers. Like, you are just dying for someone to come up to you and say, here's how to do it. Here's exactly how to do it. Here's the 5 steps to turn your kid into a great, wonderful person and have you be a great, wonderful mom. Like, so many of us are just craving that straightforward confidence that Cass gets from Lacey and these women online. And I think she's just really drawn to that confidence.
All of the women characters in your book, they carry their personal burdens, their unique burdens. But they have this thing in common. They all do this invisible labor, especially the mental and emotional work of caring for children. Remy running the supper club and caring for her kids and grandkids. And then there's Remy's daughter, Hillary, who's a divorced mom with 3 kids. Can you give an example of how this unseen labor affects life choices and relationships?
Yeah, I mean, take Hillary, for example. She's Cass's sister, and she's a single mom with 3 kids, and she's also an artist. And so while she's trying to carve out this career for herself, painting, you know, she wants to paint beautiful art for galleries, but she often finds herself doing freelance projects for cash, and she's completely by herself with these 3 kids. She doesn't have the support. She ends up doing a lot of things that would be just a lot easier if she had a partner with her, whether it's making sure they have everything for their extracurriculars, or there's a scene where she goes to Target to buy clothes for her daughter. And she talks about how it's not just finding the time to run to Target. It's noticing that the shirt doesn't fit, knowing what size to get the shirt in, knowing what style of shirt the kid wants, finding time to go to Target, making sure they have it. Like, there's so many steps involved in that are just especially hard on single moms who don't have that support, don't have that partner. And I think that's why Hillary also has a lot of complicated feelings about Cass, who's currently not living with her husband. And I think a lot of Hillary is like, girl, if I could have your man, I would in a heartbeat. Like, why would you leave such a good thing? I had to leave this horrible situation. And you're like voluntarily stepping into this life that is so hard. And I don't know if you realize that. So I think that's a lot of where the Hillary and Cass conflict comes from.
And Claire, there are some wonderful men in this book, but there are abusive men too, who hurt women and girls. How do you want us readers to grapple with the pain and the hurt in your novel?
You know, I really don't like to talk in super gendered terms about like how, oh, all these men are just abusive, and if we could just get rid of them, everything would be great. Because I think that does come out in some of our modern literature. But like, if you see Lacey, the main influencer of the Momune, she's the founder of the Momune, that's really her whole platform, is that these men have just abandoned us, let us down. The trad wife aesthetic isn't even enough. We should just be doing everything on our own. Like, we don't even need to be wives. And so that's her whole shtick, is that we don't need these men, when really I think that there's, like you said, amazing men in the book and more abusive men, and then a lot of men in between. Like, most of us all are, right? We're not these supper club saints. We're not these perfect people just walking around making amazing decisions day in and day out. But 99% of us are trying our absolute hardest. And so I think that that's something that readers can hold on to for hope in the book. All of my books, I try very hard to point towards hope, not despair. So even though there are heavy topics and very hard moments, whether it's showing abuse or medical difficulties or infertility, I really want the book to just point towards, yeah, that hope.
There is a question that Cass ponders at the end of the book. Is womanhood the process of slowly but surely understanding your mother? And that moment in the book, it makes me wonder what my own daughter thinks of my choices in life and in my parenting. How should we reckon with that question?
I read once that you either survived your mother or you liked your mother or okay, or you won the lottery. Like, those are the three sections. But to me, I think everybody really is somewhere there in the middle where, again, 99% of moms, even if, you know, a D plus was the best they could do, they were doing the best they could do. We can't see everybody's traumas, everybody's history, everybody's mental health struggles. All we see is their actions, right? And so it's so easy to look at someone and be like, why would you do that? Even like the head of the mommy and Lacey, it's like, why would she bring this pain into the world? And then when you hear more of her story, you can kind of start to connect the dots. That doesn't make it right, but it helps us to empathize with her and have compassion for her. And I think it's really easy for anybody to look at their mom and say, you know, why did you do this? Why did you have this rule? Why weren't you at this event? Or why didn't you get a job? We were poor, you know, anything, like something you can judge your mom on. But as you grow older and when you have your own kids, you realize that your mom was making 19,000 decisions a day, and she was trying to make the best ones for you. And some of them were, and some of them weren't. And you are doing the exact same thing. And so we just need to have grace for one another.
It is such an eye-opening realization when you start to walk in those shoes with your own children. Claire, this novel is Wisconsin through and through. And I wonder, what would this book be like without its Wisconsin setting or its Wisconsin supper club and so many other ways that this novel leans into your home state?
I don't even know if it could exist, because to me, it really is just such a Midwestern novel. We hear so much about like great Southern literature or books where like New York City is a character, not just the setting. But to me, in my books, Wisconsin really is a character. I love being from here. I love the Midwest. I think it's full of real salt of the earth people, you know, like we keep saying, people who are just trying their best day in and day out. People here tend to be very kind and welcoming, certainly not perfect. We definitely have flaws of our own, but there is this kind of Midwest nice heartbeat that really flows through our communities in my experience. And a supper club is the epitome of that. So I'm really honored to be writing books about where I'm from. When I was a kid, I always thought, why would you live in Wisconsin? Like, clearly when I grow up, I'm going to move to Hawaii or I'm going to move to California and like live on the beach. But now that I'm older, I mean, I've chosen to stay here for those reasons, because Wisconsin to me is all about food and family. And that's really what the book is about too.
Claire, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
Claire Swinarski's new novel is called The Supper Club Saints. It's about the struggles of modern motherhood, set in a small Wisconsin town on the shores of Lake Michigan. She writes books for adults and middle school readers, and this is her seventh book.
More and more schools around the country are banning cell phones for students in classrooms. Many Wisconsin districts have had bans in place, and last fall, a new state law imposed statewide limits.
But do those bans help students learn in the classroom? Next week, we'll look at the latest research on classroom cell phone rules.
And we want to include your experiences in that conversation. As a parent, a student, or a teacher, how much do cell phones change the classroom environment? Have you seen changes after a ban came into place?
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232.
Share your perspective on cell phones in school again at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Tim Peterson is our acting executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.